Hi, I'm Greg Mangum, CEO and founder of Only a Pavement Away. And we've started a series of podcasts. Yes, I know, a number of people do podcasts. But why should you listen to our one? Well, it's about hospitality. We've got some fantastic guests who are the leaders in the field in this industry. And it's a chance for you to find out how you can help your fellow people who are stuck in society find a better way to improve their lives. So listening to this podcast is going to give you loads of things. You're going to find out about your industry, but you're also going to find out how, by just adding a little bit extra to Only a Pavement Away, you can stop someone going to a food bank, ending up in a doorway, going back to prison, or coming out of the military, and to coin a phrase, think you've been deserted. I met someone who was a rush sleeper on Brighton Beach. When I spoke to him, he said that he'd been in private equity. He'd made a few mistakes, and he'd been rush sleeping for 10 years after earning million-pound bonuses. And he said to me, people notice us, but they don't see us. So what I'd say to you is, when you listen to this podcast, see everyone, because they're just like you and me, and they could be you and me fairly soon. So now let's get on with the Only a Pavement Away podcast. Enjoy the listening.
Hello and welcome to the Hospitality Against Homelessness podcast from Only a Pavement Away. I'm your host, Mark Stretton. I've been around the industry for 20 years, first as a business journalist at the Sunday Times, then editing publications like The Publican and MCA, before co-founding Fleet Street. On this podcast, each week I'll be speaking to a visionary hospitality leader who is changing the landscape and transforming lives through the power of hospitality. Our mission with this podcast is to expand the conversation around the opportunity hospitality has to make the world a better place. This is the podcast for people in hospitality who are passionate about our industry and ready to help transform lives. Today's guest is one of the UK's finest chefs, Tom Aitkins. Tom is patron of Only Pavement Away and a massive supporter. When we met at Brewdog in Waterloo, he was getting ready to run the kitchen at Cook and Dine, serving a three-course meal to nearly 300 hospitality people in central London. Tom knew he wanted to be a chef from the age of 8. At 11, he phoned the local college to find out what grades he needed to get into catering school. He trained with some of the world's finest chefs, and at 26, he had 2 Michelin stars. Today, he runs restaurants in London, Abu Dhabi, Jakarta, Qatar, and Tokyo. He has written several books, including 5-Minute Feasts, created during lockdown, featuring 5-minute recipes from Tom and a host of hospitality people, with all proceeds going to Only a Pavement Away. We talk about his early career, his Michelin stars, business ventures, and his work with Only a Pavement Away, why the opportunity to help people matters, and why he is so committed to the cause of hospitality against homelessness. It was a real privilege. Tom is a one-off. He's doing amazing things for Only Pavement Away, and we really hope you enjoy it. Tom, thanks so much for being here.
Pleasure. Lovely to be here.
Perhaps we'll just take a moment to just do a quick potted history for anyone that's not fully aware of you as a professional cook. Tell us about how you came up and tell us a bit about your businesses.
So I started thinking about becoming a chef when I was 11 years old. My mother was a very good home cook. We lived in Norfolk, so in the sort of countryside, in the sticks. I was very lucky to have a mother that sort of really cared about, you know, what I ate. And she grew everything in the garden. So we had a big vegetable garden. And literally any time of year, there was always something, you know, growing in the ground. So we always had sort of, you know, some fresh vegetables or something that was homemade on the table. And then on top of that, my father, he was in the wine business. So, you know, it was pretty obvious that we were going to go into some kind of food or something. My mother also taught us how to cook. Pretty sort of, you know, basic stuff. But nonetheless, we were cooking in the kitchen, you know, by the age of, you know, 9, 10, 11. And even at early ages, we were sort of helping mix cakes and things at probably the age of 5 or 6. When I left school, yeah, I went straight into college. I just went to college for 2 years, and then I thought the only place to come was in London. So I then came to London and I got myself a job in a one-star restaurant. And the only way of getting that was because this was, you know, a long time ago, 1989. So, you know, it was difficult in the fact that there were not many restaurants to go into. Plus those that were existing, they all had waiting lists for chefs to go into. So I wrote off to all these different hotels and restaurants offering my services, and they were all like, oh no, come back in a couple of years when you have more experience and more knowledge and capabilities. And I was saying, you know, I'm passionate, I'm hardworking, and da-da-da. And they were like, no. So I was like, okay, so how am I supposed to get more experience if I can't get a job? So I then said to my father, well, this is what's happened. You know, I'm thinking about just saying I'll work for nothing for 6 months to prove myself. And then if you like me or you think I'm good enough, then hopefully you'll give me a job. So again, I wrote off about 15 letters, and then literally two came back, one from the Rue brothers. And they said, sorry, we can't give you a job because we've got people that are waiting in front of you for the to get in. So, but thank you. It was a lovely letter. And then a restaurant in Battersea that doesn't exist anymore, but they had a one star called Cavaliers. He gave me a place for 6 months. I proved myself, then he gave me a job.
So you worked at Cavaliers for free for 6 months?
Yeah.
Then what happened?
So basically I then was given the job as such. So I had sort of proved myself enough, and I stayed there a year. But I had, you know, as I said, ever since, you know, I was 11, I knew that I wanted to be a chef. So I was already focused on that objective, and I was very driven to succeed. I guess I had in me a sort of an innate sort of, you know, work ethic anyway, and always have had that. And I knew, regardless of anything else, to be successful, I knew that I would have to work very, very hard. When I had decided to become a chef when I was 11, I had secretly called up the local college in Norwich where I lived next to at 11. This was before going to high school. And I basically spoke to them pretending that I was a school leaver and said that I'm interested in becoming a chef. What qualifications do you need? Is there any particular exams or blah, blah, blah? And they basically said, look, you don't need any qualifications. You come for an entrance exam. You have an interview. And basically, if we like you, we'll take you. Because this, we're talking about, you know, sort of in the 80s. So there weren't a lot of people going into catering back then. In a way, it was kind of music to my ears, because I then knew that I could go to high school knowing full well that I didn't need a single qualification, which is a little bit naughty, I would say. So for the next 5 years, I would say I had a lot of fun at school, but my parents had a bit of hell. Because literally every year, my poor parents, when they went to the parents' teachers' evening, as you would have, the teachers, I think, were sort of, you know, rubbing their hands with glee about what they were going to say to our parents about how badly behaved I had been. And I was always messing around back of the class, just being disruptive, that I was going to come to nothing and that I was a waste of time and all of this. This went on for 5 years, pretty much. And then, you know, when it came to the eventful day of getting my exam results, standing in the kitchen, my father reading the big envelope and seeing his face first of sort of hopefulness and somewhat sort of quasi-smile or smirk, thinking that maybe I have done enough to get some mediocre grades. And then suddenly that sort of royal smile smirk turned to sort of frowns and sadness. And like, basically, what the hell are you, F you, you know, going to be doing with this exam results? Because they were absolutely dreadful. And at that point, I thought I should kind of own up now to what's happened the last 5 years. And so I then told him, I said, look, I have to fess up, you know, number one is I want to become a chef. And number two is I knew 5 years ago that I didn't need any exam qualifications. He says, what the hell do you, you know, what the F, you know, do you mean by that? And I said, well, when I was 11, I called up the college and asked them, what qualifications do I need? And they said, you don't need any. And he basically, like, swore at me and said, well, that may be a good thing, but, you know, you still need results and da-da-da-da-da. And, well, thankfully, then, you know, it's a good thing, then you don't need any results, but nonetheless, you know, all this sort of, you know, lecture. So they accepted. And then the other question, he says, well, why do you want to become a chef? And I sort of looked at him and said, well, it's quite obvious, you know, you're in the wine business. Mother's a great cook. She grows vegetables and in the garden and taught us how to cook. And you could see him sort of ponder and think this over in his head and kind of accepted it. So anyway, so then went to college. Thankfully got onto the course. And then literally 3 months later, we were doing well. And one of the teachers that interviewed me came up to me in the corridor and said, you know, can I have a word with you, please? And I was like, okay, yeah. He basically said, you know, I'm keeping an eye on you, you know. I said, well, why? What do you mean? And he said, well, the only reason that you got onto this course was because you're a twin. And so we both did the same course, same interview, same everything. And he said, yeah, the only reason why we took on this course was because you're a twin. And I said, oh, that's nice to hear. Well, thanks. And he said, well, yeah, because you didn't really have a great interview and we weren't going to take you. I thought, oh, that's a nice pep talk. Thanks for that. And so as a cocky 16-year-old, I turned around to him and I said, well, I said, that may be the case, but in 10 years' time, you're going to know who I am and I'm going to be famous. And he kind of looked at me like, yeah, whatever, loser kind of face. So anyway, that gave me even more an incentive to basically say mm-mm to you as well. So as a 16-year-old, I knew that 10 years was a very long time, because when you're young, you know, you think, God, 10 years, it's like
an eternity, isn't it?
It's forever. I've got so long to do this. It's no problem. So I then even, you know, I then mapped out exactly what I was going to do, who I was going to go and work with, how I was going to do it. And that was my, I guess, other incentive. And so did my 2 years at college. Did, as I said, approach David Cavalier, got the job there. He then got me, because I did, you know, pretty well with him, he then got me a job with Pierre Kaufman, which is a 2-star restaurant. So I went to work there. 6 months into working there, they went from a 2-star to a 3-star because the Michelin guide came out.
Well,
not that it was anything to do with me, but the fact is that I was then working in a 3-star restaurant. So I was like, so once you've done that, then like doors open. You know, you've worked in a 3-star, worked in a 2-star, I've worked in a 1-star. So that then, like, I was like on a better path than I thought I would be already at that stage. And I was then only 21. I then went and worked with another chef called Richard Neat at Pierrotin, which was a 1-star. I then was his sous chef, and he also went up to a 2-star. He then got me a job with a French chef where he worked in Paris called Joël Robuchon. And at that time, Joël Robuchon was one of the best chefs in the world, without a doubt. And French gastronomy was really where it was all at. You know, Spain hadn't really come along, you know, with the Melectic Astronomy and Ferran Adrià and El Bulli and all of that. That was sort of early 2000s. So I then went and worked in Paris, got me a job there. I had only just turned 23. And it was a real eye-opener because, like, working in, A, for one of the best chefs in the world, which it was, but working in a kitchen environment where everyone is, like, going at it full guns and making sure that everything and absolutely, you know, service down to the produce, down to the team is like, you know, the best of the best of the best, the A1A. I mean, literally, like, it was a phenomenal kitchen to be in. Very pressurized, pretty extreme. I was working 100 hours a week in 5 days. You know, I was sleeping 3 hours, pretty much no more than that a night. I was getting up at quarter to five, and then I'd be at work by, you know, sort of 5:30, meet a couple of guys, have a couple of espressos, be in the kitchen at 5:45, and then start work at 6, really, and work through until 4 p.m., go out for 20 minutes, have an ice cream, come back, work until 1, and then I'd be home by 2:45, and then be out up again at 4:45.
Good grief. How many days a week?
5.
Wow.
So by Thursday, you then had splitting headache from hell, from sleep deprivation. But as I said, you know, the camaraderie in the team and working in that environment, I was, you know, it was amazing. And also in the way that he ran his kitchen was very different to the like of Pierre Kaufmann. Pierre Kaufmann was very vocal. His food wasn't so sort of creative on the plate. It was quite simple, but it was gutsy flavors and everything. Whereas Joël Robuchon, he ran his kitchen very strict. Same as Pierre Kaufmann, but in complete silence in service. No one was allowed to talk, only him. You weren't allowed to look at the checks. You had to listen. You had to write them down, what everything was. So it taught you to multitask like big time, because you had to listen. You had to write down what he said. You had to cook. You had to plate everything. So in a way, you know, it really taught you to focus on everything else as well. So after that, I then went and worked another 3-star in Champagne called Gérard Boyer, which was great. And then when I was there, I got a call from the restaurant I worked in previously, Pinotaire, which was a 2-star, saying that the chef was leaving. Would I like to, you know, take the baton? So I thought, well, hell yeah, because, like, you know, when I was then 25, I was just like, you know, not going to give him that opportunity again, probably, so let's do it. So I went, and I had a handover of like a couple of weeks with him. We notified Michelin. We timed it right. So the guide just came out. There were Richard's 2 stars. He then left. I took over. So I had basically 11 months till the next guide came out, or 10 months, you know. And I don't know how many visits I probably had there, you know, by Michelin, but quite a lot. I thought, okay, I can keep one. You know, but a lot of people were hedging their bets that I wouldn't have any. It was so hard because all the staff left because they didn't think that I was, you know, going to accomplish anything. Nobody knew me anyway, so it was impossible to get people to come and work for me. So it was literally like myself and, you know, 2-3 other guys most. And we're all working, you know, 80, 90 hours a day. I was coming in my day off as well to get ahead. So it was a nightmare. It was horrible. And then at the end of it, you know, when the guy came out, I kept 2 stars.
Amazing. And at that point, they become your stars.
Yes. So that was a big relief. I was very happy. But it was a lot of hard work.
Yeah, and then you were 26 at that point.
I was 26, yeah. Yeah, I was 26. I just had my birthday in February. The guy came out in January. I had my 26th birthday in February. So
well, that's incredible. And so that made you the youngest chef with 2 stars.
It was, yeah. It was an amazing experience and everything. And the fact that I was then the youngest, I had like a huge amount of press and PR and everything. And I then sent all these clippings to my teacher.
Amazing.
And I said, I don't know if you remember me, but I said in the corridor in a conversation with you, in 10 years' time, you're going to know who I am and I'm going to be famous. And I left it at that.
And did you receive a response?
I did, yeah. I should have kept the letter, but I didn't. I don't know what happened to it. But I got a letter from him, and he was very chuffed, very happy for me. And then they put a picture of me up in the corridor as a Hall of Fame.
Excellent.
Mm. Yeah.
When you received your exam results, and you had that, you were with your father, and you also had that charming conversation in the corridor at college. Were you kind of impervious to that sort of stuff, did you question yourself?
I was totally impervious to it because I just knew that I was going to be successful. Because I was driven, I was motivated, I was hungry, and I kind of knew. It's a very simple sum. For me, hard work will pay off eventually. It does. Like, you know, if you're determined and you're driven and you have a goal of where you want to go, and I say this to everyone, like, you know, you can come from any background. If you have the ambition, and yes, you need a bit of luck for sure, but at the end of the day, you also make your own luck because in the way that, you know, you orchestrate it and in your focus and your hard work and your own ability, you know, you can achieve anything. And that's really down to you, I think, in terms of, yes, there's quite a little bit of stubbornness and mental strength there as well. But, you know, I knew that if I just worked hard, put my nose to the ground and just like went for it, I could do it, right? No problem.
Mm.
And that was it, really. That was the game plan. Work hard.
Amazing. I relate to that in a way in that I worked in national newspapers and long hours, surrounded by brilliant people, sense that you're crafting something every day, every week. You worked some horrendous hours.
Horrendous.
How has the kitchen and the culture evolved from those 90, 100 sleep-deprived days?
Thank God it has, because there wouldn't be anyone around. But anyway, it's. I sound like an old dinosaur, because the last thing I want to do is be preaching like an old granddad. You don't know, but if I remember the old days. But I think, you know, thank God that it has had, you know, a refresh, and it's moved on from 30, you know, plus years ago. There wasn't anything nice about it, I would have to say, apart from the fact of what you were learning. But the thing is, I didn't know any different, so you just accepted it and went along with it. Since we've had COVID and lockdown and the way people have had an opportunity, particularly in hospitality, to, I guess, just refocus and align their lives on what they want, it's had a dramatic impact. And then on top of that, we had Brexit. So we then had this massive void of people that left the industry, like massive, and everyone was like going frantic. They've got no staff. And then I think everyone had to realign themselves to their staff rather than to the business. And everyone wants to have people work for them that are happy in what they do. But it can't always be that way, you know, because in a way of trying to make everyone happy in what they want is, to me, you know, almost sometimes impossible. But you can give a structure, I think, in terms of making the environment an enjoyable, friendly, happy place. And then, you know, the two biggest things for people is in terms of hours and salary. They go hand in hand. I think once you get those aligned in the right place, then everything kind of, you know, slots in. So I think with COVID, with lockdown, when a lot of people left, everyone really sort of had to take a step back, refocus on what it was that made and gave people the chance to have a life, and then also enough time and work to make a business work in the way that it should. So we, you know, we've reduced the hours that people work, and then give them a good amount of time off where, you know, they can enjoy themselves, see their friends, see their family, go out, whatever. So all the staff now, you know, in the kitchen, they do 3.5 days on and 3.5 days off. So it's 50-50. They work hard the 3.5 days, but, you know, they then have 3.5 days as well to enjoy themselves and do what they like. So it means that, you know, we've now got a good balance where staff are having a great work environment where they can come and work hard, enjoy it, and know that they've got 3.5 days off. And the big noticeable difference in my time, you know, I would say that I was not bothered about money. I wasn't bothered about working 90 to 100 hours because I didn't know any different. They do now, you know. It's not acceptable. I was incentivized as well by obviously success and being, you know, to a degree a leader, be it a head chef or a restaurant owner. And I'm not saying, you know, the young today aren't motivated. Of course, they're motivated and they're driven to do the job that they have to do in hospitality, because it is still very hard. But what I'm saying is that I think for them now, as long as they're in an environment where they know that they're learning, it's fun, they have a good amount of time off, that is for them is more of a key and focus, you know, for them. And what we're seeing is that, you know, staff are staying a lot longer. You know, for me, it was about jumping from one job to another, you know, work a year, move, and then you gain more experience, more knowledge, you go up the ladder more. But I think now, in a way, it's nice, a balance for us, because we're not chopping and changing staff all the time, and it means for us we get better consistency in what we do. It's a lot smoother, a lot easier transition, you know, when we create a new dish, because everyone knows what's happening. So in a way, you know, the young are staying longer, and it's a much better, you know, working environment for everyone.
A quick word on our podcast partner, Britvic. We're thrilled to be partnering Britvic for Hospitality Against Homelessness, the Only a Pavement Way podcast. Britvic is a global organisation with 38 much-loved brands sold in over 100 countries. From Fruit Shoot and Robinson's to Jimmy's Iced Coffee and J2O, for Britvic, it's all about enjoying life's everyday moments today and creating a better tomorrow. Britvic wants to contribute positively to the world around us. It's why its Healthier People, Healthier Planet sustainability strategy is at the heart of everything its teams do. And it's why Britvic are proud supporters of Only a Pavement Away. Thank you, Britvic. We're really delighted to be partnering with Imbiba for Hospitality Against Homelessness, the Only a Pavement Away podcast. Imbiba are the leading private equity firm in UK hospitality, leisure and experiential industries. They back some of our best known and most exciting growth companies, names like Pizza Pilgrims, F1 Arcade and Big Fan Collective, to mention just three. By backing talent, providing growth funding and lending their invaluable sector expertise, they make a massive difference, helping to shape the future of these amazing businesses and our industry. For more, visit imbiba.com. That's Imbiba, imbiba.com. Thanks, Imbiba. It's great to have you with us. That moving around, working with all those top chefs, that was your education, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Do you see the next generation coming through that really want to do what you did? You know, they've sort of got this unstoppable desire to get to the top.
I would say that some of them definitely do. I think in terms of, you know, when I look back at all the chefs that have come through my kitchens and worked, there's, you're still talking probably, you know, 1.5% that will actually get there. But not saying that the others, they won't make it, but they may not want to be a restaurant owner and they may not want the stress of being that, because it is stressful. It's not easy. And then you're also thinking about the welfare of all your staff and, you know, it's a whole nother level of mental approach, you know, to it. But I think, you know, the world due to social media has become a much smaller place. And for chefs now, where they can see because of Instagram, chefs from all over the world in amazing different restaurants. I didn't have that, so I couldn't see what was going on in Mexico or California or Australia, whereas now, you know, you just go and search on a well-known chef and you can see what they're up to. So the world is their oyster. I think with restaurants and hospitality, it's never been as exciting and as interesting as it is now, because you can go absolutely anywhere with cooking. You can travel the world, you can go to other cities, destinations. And again, the scope of work of what you can do is not just about being a chef, but like the other doors that it can go and open is huge. So the platform of restaurants and hospitality, I think, is so diverse and so mixed in terms of also the different cuisines and levels of restaurants, not just fine dining, that you can go into is really exciting and interesting. So I think for me, there's never been a better time to come into restaurants.
Do you think we tell that story enough or well enough?
I don't think so, no. I think for school leavers who, you know, it's such a difficult and stressful decision at a very early age to decide what the hell you're going to do with your life, let alone the next 2 years. You know, I think it's very daunting. And a lot of them, they change their minds halfway through because it's just not something they want to do. And that only really comes with maturity and understanding and life experience, you know, because even now I've seen people who have had executive positions who've suddenly decided they want to become a chef, you know, and that's fine, that's great, it's amazing, you know, because I think finding something that you're passionate about and really happy is the best thing. There's no point working in an environment that you begrudgingly go to, because it's just not great for your mental well-being either.
Life's too short.
It is. So finding a job, a career path that suits you is so important. And that's why I think, you know, for people who, you know, have that horrendous stress of having to take, you know, A levels and going to higher college and studying, it's tough. Because at the end of the day, you know, when you've got all those amazing results and degrees, diplomas, you may not even need them.
Did you at any point regret not studying for those exams?
No, not one bit.
You're not one of those people that has exam revision nightmares?
Not at all. No, I didn't. No, I just didn't do it. So I was lucky.
So you've got kids now?
I do, yeah.
And what's your message to them?
Well, they're 9 and 11. Two girls, very feisty, very stubborn.
Where do they get that from?
I really don't know. I really scratch my head every morning. I'm like, why are they like a chip off the old block, I wonder? Because they are. So they are, yeah, I'd say they're both a force of nature. They really are. And I just say to them that I still obviously bang on about how important education is because they both don't particularly like school. They don't. I don't know where that comes from me, but, you know, who knows? But I still say that education, it is important. You do need at least a base. But at the end of the day, you never know where your child is going to grow up and do because the world is such a big place. And in terms of what you can do, it's endless, you know, it really is. And trying to pigeonhole your son, your daughter, whoever, into something when they're a teenager, I think it's tough. It really is. I just want them to be happy and fulfilled in what they want to do. And I think if you have that passion, you'll find the road, the path eventually to what you want to do.
If we bring it forward to now, I think this industry has a huge culture of helping people, helping the next generation coming up.
It does.
I think it's one of those things where you do learn on the job. So there's a huge amount of mentoring and coaching and teaching in the job. How are we doing as an industry at that?
I would always say we could do more, but I would say the way that restaurants, hotels are doing so much more for staff now because they realise the value of good staff now. They do, everyone does. So in a way, you know, the only way to, I guess, to keep them happy is to give them a real proper career path, you know, in what they want to do and to guide them and train them and teach them, educating them and guiding them into a career where they can grow and nurture and prosper. And I think for me, you know, no matter what chefs I have through my door, you know, I always tell them, you know, whatever age they are, you really have to have, you know, a goal and a purpose. It's not just about, okay, coming into this industry and working. And at the end of the day, you need a goal of where you're going and what you're doing and the dream, the aspiration. What is it that you want out of it? Where do you see yourself in 10 years? Because we all need that, at least some kind of direction into what we're doing and a purpose, because otherwise you're just on a merry-go-round of to nothing. So I really try and instill that in them and to think about the bigger picture of what this industry can do for them. Because at the end of the day, it is super exciting. It's super interesting and sometimes can be, of course, challenging and hard and difficult, but the positivity far outweighs anything else. You know, I mean, for me, I don't think there is anything negative about it anymore. There isn't. And I think, you know, being positive about it and helping people to a degree realize what they can do, because again, you know, it's about instilling confidence into people to say, hey, you know what, you can do that, you can achieve this, you can go and do that. Because for some of them, they don't believe that window can be pushed open and go through another door here and another door there. And I mean, a prime example that I have sent, you know, many chefs abroad to go and work. And one particularly is a chef that worked with me back in 2003, was a pastry chef, Elwin Boyles. He worked with me for about a year and a half at Tom Aiken's, and he had a pretty mediocre CV, nothing great, to be honest. He was very quiet, very shy, quite reserved, but I could see that he was talented as hell. I could see that, you know, you instantly know within seconds about a chef if they're good or if they're great or if they're amazing or they're going to go somewhere. You know, it was pretty obvious. And I just knew that he had something, you know. Anyway, he came to me one day and said, look, you know, I'm thinking about moving on. And I said to him, well, what do you want to do? And he says, oh, well, I want to maybe, you know, go to this place or, you know, go and work in a pastry shop. And I was like, really? I said, what about, you know, if you went and worked abroad somewhere? He says, what do you mean? I said, well, you know, go and work with Thomas Keller, for instance, or something like that. He said, no, I'm not going to do that. I can't do that. I said, yeah, you can. You can do that. Absolutely. So I then helped him to get a job with Thomas Keller, who's a three-star chef in New York, per se. He has French Laundry as well in California. Anyway, so he went, and he stayed with him for 17 years. 17 years he was with him. Probably, I think, one of the longest-standing members of staff, almost, in terms of the kitchen. He ran pastry in French Laundry, per se.
Wow.
Bouchon, ran a lot.
He just needed that helping hand.
He just needed that, just to say, you can do it.
So you put your hand up effectively to work with Only a Pavement Away. You reached out to them.
Yes.
Perhaps you could talk a bit about why Only a Pavement Away and obviously why the issues that, you know, it is involved with sports.
So I've always, for at least the last, 15, 20 odd years have helped various different charities and charitable causes. And, it's a nice thing to do, to give something back and to help other people when you can. Definitely my time, is precious, but saying that, I always know that there are less fortunate people in the world, and it's nice, as I said, to give, something back in terms of my time or what I can, give to people. And the reason why with Only a Pavement Away is that they fundamentally help homeless people get back off the streets and into a job working in hospitality. So I think in terms of an actual charitable cause, it's not just, helping them, it's giving them a purpose again. Because I think with a lot of homeless people, and they come from all, different backgrounds, as we've seen, some come, from the army, some, have either been on bad luck with, either alcohol or drug abuse, and they all come from different, walks of life. My thing is, you can never judge people on their own backgrounds, because you never know where they've come from or on the hard luck that they've gone through. And I think for me personally, I do find it quite heartbreaking, when you do see people on the streets and they're hungry or they're sleeping in rough conditions. And I know that helping this with this charity, it is really helping these people. And I think the main thing with this charity is it's not just about helping them, it's about giving them a purpose. And I think giving them confidence as well in the fact that they can do something with their lives. Because you get many different walks of life for people who are on the street, from, teenagers up to, elderly people. And I think it's just recognizing that these people, they can do something. They can be put in a work environment to help if they're given, the right platform to do it.
Mm. That confidence thing is huge, isn't it?
It is, yeah, definitely. Because I think, when you look at someone who's on the street, they've definitely had the confidence taken out of them somewhere. And I guess it's just reinstilling that belief in them that they can do something, that they can accomplish something with their lives. And it doesn't mean that they have to be, a CEO of a company, but it's just actually giving them the tools to be able to say, yes, we're here to help you, but we can also put you, in a workplace environment where we feel that you can achieve and grow and prosper, and getting that confidence back and giving them, I think, that real boost of morale is what a lot of them sometimes need as well. We all need that.
Absolutely. You have to be careful that homeless people don't become invisible.
Mm.
It's very easy, especially in London, that you can just walk past someone without really recognising that they're there.
Yeah, it is. And particularly where, I work around Victoria, or on the other side of Victoria, which is the posher part, I would say, Belgravia. But even so, I come quite often through Victoria where there is a lot of homeless people around that area. And some, as I said, some have been, victims of drug and alcohol abuse. But even so, it's a nasty place to be in. It's a deep, dark hole. And people need a helping hand to get out of that. And I think, when you see people on the streets, you just have no idea what it's like, living on the street, not knowing that you've got food to feed yourself, water to drink, you know, a bed to sleep in, it must be, you know, horrific. Safety as well, with the conditions that they, you know, that they have to live with every day, it's tough and harrowing. And I do find it, you know, pretty upsetting when you see, you know, homeless people.
Mm. A lot of people in our industry, they don't conform educationally, spend a lot of time in school and in education feeling like they're not getting it right.
Yeah.
There's something relatable there to, you know, when someone does fall on tough times, or, you know, you're talking about someone who's vulnerable because they've fallen into sort of difficult circumstances. There is something very relatable about hospitality stepping in and giving these people, you know, a chance and some structure and an opportunity to rebuild, isn't there?
Yeah, I think at the minute, if you look at industries that are booming, restaurants is one of them. Everyone needs to eat. Everyone is always looking for a new place to go to. It provides an infrastructure. It provides a sort of a career path in terms of your own growth of what you can do. There's support, gives you education, gives you grounding. You make new friends. I mean, it ticks a hell of a lot of good boxes. It really does. Like, I think in terms of, you know, any other industry where you'll work with a like-minded bunch of good people who are kind of focused but also may want to have fun as well. It's not always, you know, serious. You know, you work with a group of interesting, dynamic, different people. And in that area, whatever it is in terms of a restaurant or kitchen, you meet some amazing customers and guests as well. Like, you may not have even realized who they were or what they do. You may meet some very famous people. You may go and get asked to go and work for some interesting people, whatever. So as I said, the doors to what you can go and do is just, you know, it's endless. And then, you know, I've seen, you know, many chefs go and work into private areas and work with some incredibly, obviously, famous people and whatever. And again, I've been asked and to go and cook for different amazing people. And again, it just opens lots of doors and avenues. Do you think that would never be possible? But it is.
And for anyone out there listening that wants to get involved with Only Pavement Away or is thinking about starting a program to help vulnerable people get into employment, what would your message be to them?
Only a Pavement Away has so much to offer in terms of help, in terms of assistance, in terms of guidance, and also, you know, it has a career path of getting people into hospitality, re-educating them or educating them further. So, you know, at the end of the day, if you feel that you have a capability of giving some free time to help, whether that's an hour or whatever, you know, it's something. And if you feel that you, you know, have the passion and the mental strength to, you know, to help other people, then, you know, please come and help, because it is, as I said, it's very rewarding to be able to give back. I'm now on my third Cook and Dine.
And explain what the madness is that is Cook and Dine.
So Cook and Dine is basically a charitable lunch that we do. I think the first one we did was 250, then it was 270 or 280, and now it's 310.
You know, given what you do and the level of cooking you're into, why would you take that on?
It's a lot of fun. Everyone there is helping, giving their own time for a great charity and a great cause. And, you know, it's having, I think, all those people who are very thoughtful and passionate about the charity, all under one roof, and having a good fun and good time, and knowing that we're all helping in raising a significant amount of money for a great charity. So it's a small amount of my time, I think, for a bigger and better cause, you know?
Yeah, it is a brilliant event. And how do you approach the menu, something like that?
That's a very good question, because nowadays with everyone's allergens and allergies and allergic to this and can't eat this and can't eat that, and yeah, it's quite difficult. It does limit to what you can use, but you still got to make the menu. So we kind of stuck to a formula where we do a soup, because we can make it vegetable-based and we can make it without any dairy or anything. So that's pretty easy. And then the main course, we would do some for the vegans, and so that's for, you know, any vegetarians as well. And then, you know, it's just about making something that's quick and easy to send out fast and furious, because doing 300 covers is, you know, it's a lot of mouths, that's for sure. So we're doing, starter is a white bean soup with some truffle. We are then doing some braised shoulder of lamb, so wrapped in cabbage as a boudin, so I can slice it and send it quite fast. Greg was very excited about the pudding. I'm doing a exotic fruit rice pudding. So he's very chuffed about that. So yes, we're just trying to make it as easy and as quick as possible in terms of, you know, facilitating that amount of people.
Yeah. Sounds like a busy lunchtime.
It will be. So we start the prep on Sunday before, functions on the Wednesday. So basically we'll, you know, we got Sunday, Monday, Tuesday to do all the prep. And then Wednesday, again, early start to get it all up there and get it ready for lunchtime.
Well, best of luck.
Thank you.
Well, look, for reaching out in the first place, for being so, I mean, so great to have such a high profile person as an ambassador for Only a Pavement Away, for the book, for Cook and Dine, and for everything that you do for Only a Pavement Away. Thank you, and thanks for joining us today.
Pleasure. No problem. Thank you.
A quick word of thanks to BrewDog. BrewDog have been absolutely brilliant in helping us pull this podcast together, giving us unlimited free access to their podcast facilities in Waterloo in London. If you haven't been, check it out. It's an amazing space, almost 30,000 square feet of bars, restaurants, cafes. There's a slide, there's a bowling alley, there's meeting rooms, and of course, there's the podcast studio. Thank you, BrewDog. We couldn't have done it without you. Okay, we're now going to meet someone who has gone above and beyond for Only a Pavement Away. Today, it's Katie Moses. Katie is one of the sector's leading voices in research and insights. As founder of CAM, she works with all sorts of companies and brand owners and regularly speaks at various industry conferences and gatherings. She's best known for the charity bike ride, pedalling for pubs. She's going to tell us a lot more about that. Tell us about how you're involved with Only a Pavement Away.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me on. So a few years ago, pre-pandemic, because of course everything is either pre or post-pandemic now, right? I was made aware of what Greg and the team at Only a Pavement Away, and of course the team was incredibly small at that point, were doing. And I thought, I think that's really, really interesting, giving people the opportunity to be rehabilitated and to go back into society. And I thought, right, I'd really like to be involved in that. I like the way that it's pitched as we are people that do good, we're not do-gooders. And the idea that is not just about charity, it's also about plugging a gap that we have in the hospitality industry. And then the idea also that, of course, though, once you put somebody back into work within hospitality, so you've helped someone, you've filled a gap in hospitality, and you're also then putting money into the UK economy. So I just couldn't see any negative with working with Only a Pavement Away once I understood that's what they did.
So what happened then?
So then I had this crazy idea that we could put together, I mean, this is how naive I was. I thought, oh, yeah, we'll just have a little cycle round somewhere. So we put together a charity bike ride that is purely hospitality professionals. We call it Pedalling for Pubs, and then we get the industry to sponsor us. And then that money goes back into Only a Pavement Away. So the idea of Pedalling for Pubs was born, and as was Jordan 2020. Can you guess what happened next?
I think I can. Tell us. Go on.
So then there was this little thing called a global pandemic, and the whole world went bonkers, and so we had to postpone it. So then it became Jordan 2021. Then it became Jordan 2022. And Jordan 2022 did actually happen, much to everyone's surprise, not least mine.
And how much did you raise for Jordan?
We raised £274,000.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And then what? So you went on another ride this year.
So then Sri Lanka was booked and born. And Sri Lanka was supported as well by Pedalling Two Pubs, which was the idea of Steve Alton, chief executive of the BII, who thought that it would be really good to have an accessible UK ride that's not quite as much of a challenge, but, you know, can get people involved. And it was the idea that we would cycle from pub to pub to pub. So we then had those both running. And then next year we will be doing the same.
And this year, with Pedalling Four Pubs and Pedalling Two Pubs, you raised how much?
gives me goosebumps. We raised £400,000, Mark.
That is absolutely incredible. Yeah. So, you know, half of that going to Only Bone Away, half of it going to Licensed Trade Charity. So with a fair wind, with 2024's two rides, if my math serves me right, you're going to smash through the £1 million mark for the three rides put together, aren't you?
That is the plan. Yeah, absolutely. That's the plan. It is mind-blowing. And I know we've achieved it, but remember that we've achieved it as a team. You know, we had 25 riders year one. We had 26 riders year two. And we've got 30 for next year. And next year is going to be Kenya.
Amazing.
Which is quite spectacular.
So you're bringing, once again, heat, hills,
yep,
sand,
yep,
discomfort, but also you're chucking in deadly animals as well. I'm not talking about anyone attending the trip either.
Yes, we are. We just figured there needed to be that extra push for people to go a little bit faster, because you know what they say, you just don't want to be the slowest one in the pack. So, yeah, I think Kenya's going to be pretty spectacular.
That's amazing. Well, look, well done. I'm sort of interested to just ask you about why. Why did you feel compelled to get involved with Only a Pavement Away?
So it's a very personal mission, really. My mother, who unfortunately passed away 7 years ago now, although you know what it's like, it always seems like yesterday when you've lost somebody. She was actually a teacher in prisons. So when she died, the prison governor invited myself, my brother, my grandmother and my husband in to hide down to meet with some of the staff, to meet with some of the offenders that she taught, and to have a lunch, because they actually have the Clink there, which I'm sure a lot of the people that are listening to this know is a not-for-profit restaurant that is run by prisons and by offenders to teach them the skills that it takes to work in hospitality. So we went in and I met a lot of people that she had obviously helped, and I was given a stack of letters. And these letters were, you know, addressed to dear D. Moses' family. And they really waxed lyrical about the changes that she had made in their life and the chances and opportunities that she had given them or opened up to them. And it made me think that despite a tricky personal relationship with her, that actually what she did out in the wider world was pretty incredible. And when I heard what Only a Pavement Away were doing, I thought, this could be a really good way for me to honour her and her memory, to give back something to society where I really actually care about it, and also for it to be all linked in with the industry I love. So it was just a bit of a no-brainer, really. And we've actually launched the Deborah Moses Turnaround Bursary, which is funded by myself and by Greg at Only a Pavement Away. And every year, in my mum's name, we are going to invite applications from ex-offenders to apply for a grant, and it is a grant, there is nothing to pay back, of around £4,000 for anything that they need in order to increase the opportunity that they have now that they are out in wider society. And we've had people who have asked for grants towards a food truck. We had somebody who wants to go into working within hospitality, but the role that they want, they need to have driving license. And so driving license is what they've asked for. We've also had somebody that wants to do a level 1, 2 and 3 in whatever sort of culinary skill that they want. At the Cook and Dine event in September, we will be announcing the winner of that bursary. And that's going to be an annual thing. So it's a very personal reason for being involved, but it's a very public benefit that comes from it, I guess.
Yeah, that's amazing. You've galvanised the whole industry. You've helped to raise an enormous amount of money. Obviously, you run your own business, but you're creating a real legacy with what you're doing with Pedalling for Pubs. So on behalf of Only Pavement Away and the industry, thank you. And thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. What a pleasure.
So that's about it for episode one. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. Tune back in next week when I'll be talking to founder and CEO of Only a Pavement Away, Greg Mangum, about his mad idea, inverted commas, that became a charity helping hundreds of people facing homelessness back into employment in hospitality. We'll see you then.